There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello, and welcome to Media Geek, your weekly look at grassroots and independent media in our media environment. My name is Drew Tirico. I'll be your host for today. I'm usually the producer, but Paul is out of town today. He'll be back again next week. Today in the studio with me is John Anderson, founder of DIYmedia.net, who's going to be filling us in on what's going on in low-power FM in the FCC and a new experimental low-power AM implementations, along with some happenings in the micro-broadcasting world. Plus, we'll have some headlines for you, so you will want to stay tuned. See you soon. Here at Media Geek, we want to remind you that Media Geek headline news features stories about our media environment that typically get relegated to the back pages and business pages of print and electronic media. News about our media and its policies is not just important to investors, but affects all of us if we are to effectively strive toward a democratic society. Here's what's been going on for the week of February 14th, 2005. The Indiana State Legislature has effectively killed a bill that we've mentioned on previous editions of Media Geek that would have made it more difficult for municipalities to offer public internet services. Indiana House Bill 1148 stated that any political subdivision interested in offering telecommunication services to a community would have been forced to conduct market research about its community to find out if private enterprise could provide the same services. The municipality would then have had to hold a public hearing and finally determine the costs and benefits of the project. In addition, the bill would have required municipal services to abide by all existing antitrust laws. This bill, which is strikingly similar to cousins of it that have appeared in state legislatures in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and now Illinois, has been hailed by critics as an effort on the part of the telecom lobbyists to place expensive roadblocks in the path of municipal internet service. Sasha Meinrath, project coordinator of the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network, has stated this on his blog concerning the Ohio legislation passed in December. Quote, "The Ohio law goes far beyond what Pennsylvania passed. It's far harsher, enforces non-local control over local broadband service provision, eliminates the most cost-effective choices for consumers, and requires municipalities to provide an inordinate amount of information not required by private interests. Information so unwieldy that it makes public provision of services near on impossible. Finally, this law allows anyone to sue municipalities if they feel that public provision would adversely affect their business model. Note, this doesn't mean their service has to be cheaper, just that it would be adversely affected. Thus, an expensive service provider who is overcharging residents could sue to stop municipal provision since they would be, quote, likely to be adversely affected, end quote. And that's referring to section 1332.09B of the law that was passed in Ohio. And that's an end quote of Sasha. And as a subheadline for that, Senator Stephen J. Rauschenberger, a Republican from a suburb of Chicago, he's a state senator, has introduced a clause with similar language to the Illinois State Senate Bill 0499, reading, quote, "No political subdivision of this state shall provide or offer for sale, either to the public or to a telecommunications provider, a telecommunications service or telecommunications facility used to provide a telecommunications service for which a certificate of service authority is required pursuant to this section," end quote. According to a Northwest suburb paper, the Daily Herald, quote, if successful, such a change could have tremendous local impact. It would stifle potential plans to bring businesses into a 175-mile fiber optic loop known as the Northern Illinois Technology Triangle, which will run along I-88, I-90, and I-39. It would head off efforts similar to those in the Tri-Cities last year for city-owned and operated internet, cable TV, and phone systems. Voters defeated the idea by a two-thirds margin. And 12 towns with state permission to offer a wide range of telecommunications services would no longer have the ability to do so, end quote. So, Illinois could be in store for a fate similar to Ohio and Pennsylvania. And in corporate collusion news, Sinclair Broadcast Group is working on a deal with America's largest cable provider, Comcast, to put its digital content on all of the cable network's local channels, increasing its number of stations by over 500%. Last week, Sinclair President and CEO David Smith outlined the company's plans to open the cable pipeline to as many as 5 additional Sinclair channels for each of the 62 stations currently under the broadcaster's control. The move, as TV broadcasting continues its transition to a digital format, has the potential to grow Sinclair's considerable holdings to 372 stations. Having thus far failed to do so via official channels at the FCC and in Congress, Sinclair is taking a new tack, striking deals directly with the cable carriers. And the Sinclair Comcast deal is just the tip of the iceberg. Smith told his investors that, quote, in the event that we do get a deal done with Comcast, my sense is that it will kind of lay the groundwork for every other cable company within our industry where we broadcast, end quote. And that's what's been going on this week in our media environment. We'll be right back with John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. Do stay tuned. And that was a little bit of Joan of Arc from their latest album. And it's a track titled, And Most of All 80s Dance Parties. And I'll leave you to ponder exactly what that's supposed to mean. So now we're going to talk to John. John Anderson here with me in the studio of DIYmedia.net. He's also a PhD student at the Institute for Communications Research here at the University of Illinois. And he's a returning guest on Media Geek. Welcome back.
Surprise, surprise. I'm back again.
And you had a comment about that Sinclair multicast digital channel.
Yeah, this is just kind of a weird conceptual thing, but if you think about digital television stations, one of the things that has been talked about as a possibility DTV stations can do is they can multicast. Multicast means effectively compressing multiple channels onto a single channel. And this is something that digital television does have the technological possibility of doing. I know public television stations are really interested in doing this, and PBS has kind of led the way in developing the multicast technology. The funny thing is if you split the bandwidth up among a single DTV channel, none of the resulting multi-channels can broadcast in high definition.
So you're
using the bandwidth to do multiple program streams, all of which have to, you know, have a slight quality degradation in order to fit.
Mm-hmm. So you're not actually taking advantage of that digital carrier. In fact, what Sinclair may be doing with this is taking advantage of the fact that they can broadcast several channels on this one channel that they may get with Comcast to broadcast across the network, and they'll be able to provide 6 times more content and indeed a lower resolution and fidelity to consumers.
Yes, especially, you know, and the big thing is going to be, what is that content going to be? I mean, Sinclair is well known for its willingness to use the airwaves to advance its political philosophies as
Absolutely.
A corporation. And, you know, what if those channels are all kind of, you know, friendly GOP-style programming?
Right. and it's shown itself to be very hostile to local content. It's centralized most of its news operations, with the rare exception of one of the ones here in Illinois that is probably going to change to an ABC affiliate soon, so that it can avoid the controversy with NBC.
Yeah,
because NBC requires most of pretty much all of their affiliates to have a local news team, but ABC does not have that requirement. So Sinclair is probably going to be pushing them to centralize the news very soon.
Yeah,
as we've mentioned before.
In a related development, Dish TV subscribers, Dish Network subscribers, now have access to the Pentagon Channel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the channel that's fed to U.S. armed forces by the Pentagon around the world, now available on Dish Network. Woohoo!
Wow. Well, the Dish Network is quite a venue for all kinds of different channels. I mean, there's Free Speech TV, there's
Absolutely.
Link TV,
yeah,
and now you have the Pentagon channel
right.
on there, too. So you get all sides of the issue. I'd say that gives my recommendation to the Dish Network, definitely.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up, Dish Network, for all your diverse programming, including your programming that comes directly from the Pentagon. So, John, we were just chatting a little bit there, but I wanted to get into some of what's been going on with low-power FM lately. Now, we've talked about low-power FM before on Media Geek. This is it used to be around, you know, can you give us a little bit of background on low-power FM? You know, sort of, it used to be around in the 70s, and
yeah.
then it got cut, and...
Yeah, initially there was a license, a style of license, a class of license called the Class D FM radio license, which was for stations of 100 watts or less. They were primarily located on college campuses, and the stations were effectively designed to be broadcast laboratories, so that people that were interested in going into radio, students could get some hands-on experience, make some mistakes, and they wouldn't be heard over a wide ranging area. And that was back, I think, like in the 40s and 50s when FM radio was developed, implemented. That was one of the license categories. When the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 came about,
mm-hmm.
And that created not only PBS but National Public Radio, NPR was looking for places where they would base their affiliates. What radio stations would they use to distribute the network? And the logical conclusion that NPR came up with is universities. Universities have an educational component to them. National Public Radio is going to have an educational component in its mission. Therefore, we should base the stations on college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these college campuses, however, already had these low-power FM radio stations. So what NPR convinced the FCC to do is effectively phase out Class D licenses in order to make room for higher power radio stations, which could then be sited on college campuses and carry public radio programming. That rulemaking was implemented, I want to say, like in 1978, was supposed to be fully effective by 1980, and essentially what it did was it destroyed the Class D licensing system and effectively outlawed low-power radio. There was no more license available for low-power
right.
radio. Now we fast forward to 1988 or 1998. A couple of petitions for rulemaking went in front of the FCC to resurrect a low-power radio service. The FCC chewed it over, opened it up for public comment, and in 2000, they issued a low-power FM radio service, the parameters for it, and put the rules out there. The National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio were not happy. They overhyped concerns of interference from these little low-power stations interfering with their 10,000, 50,000-watt stations, and they effectively convinced enough people in Congress to pass legislation attached to a spending bill, actually, so it was kind of on the sly, to curtail what the FCC originally wanted done. After that, the FCC...
What was it that the FCC originally wanted done?
The FCC, when they proposed low-power FM radio, they relaxed some of the interference protection standards, which govern where stations can fit on the dial and how far away they
mm-hmm.
must be
mm-hmm.
From other stations. The FCC effectively said, receiver technology has improved since these initial rules that we're using were written decades ago,
mm-hmm.
and there's space on the dial that we should be able to fit more stations in. So what we're doing is we're going to modify the interference technical rules to allow stations to fit on places on the dial where current law says they can't go. The National Association of Broadcasters and NPR portrayed that as the FCC was intentionally going to shoehorn stations onto the dial, and when you just put more signals on the air, they will interfere with each other by their very nature, which is not true. But again, like I said, convinced Congress that it was, and who in Congress
mm-hmm.
is a broadcast engineer?
Exactly. So this is where the MITRE report comes in. The
right.
MITRE report was issued that says, this interference claims of the National Association of Broadcasters is largely bogus.
Right. And that report was supposed to be done in 2001, it didn't get done until 2003. And in the meantime, the FCC went ahead and implemented this, implemented the scaled back version of the LPFM service. And currently, there's more than 550 low power FM radio stations on the air around the country. That's obviously a fraction of what the initial more lenient interference protection rules would have allowed. The MITRE report, which you mentioned, came back. That was an independent study commissioned by Congress. And they effectively said that the rules under which low-power FM were operating were too strict. It could be expanded back out to the FCC's initial proposal, and the subject should be dropped, and we should just move forward. Since then, there really hasn't been much that's happened. A couple of allies in the Senate have, in past sessions, most notably last year, introduced a bill attempting to repeal the initial chicanery that was done back in 2000 to eviscerate low-power FM. But this year, things look a little bit more promising.
Yeah, that's right. So Maria Cantwell has sort of been heading up the fight on this, and there's a group of other congressmen that have, and congresspersons that have tried to reintroduce this bill to get these initial stations back. And so can you fill us in on what's going on with that?
Yeah, like I said, last year there was a bill introduced by Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, and John McCain, Republican of Arizona, and it didn't go anywhere. They weren't able to get it into a committee. Right. They weren't able to get it out of committee. It just died. Mm-hmm. These three same senators have reintroduced this legislation this year, although they have modified it somewhat to in response to some of the things that have happened in the radio landscape since the last time they tried. Most notably, this involved the FCC opening up a window for applications for FM translator stations, which in a very basic way are stations of 250 watts or less that are primarily rebroadcasters of other programming from elsewhere.
Could be high power stations,
right,
too.
Which could be high power stations. It could be satellite fed. But effectively, these stations are not local low power FM stations. The FCC received 13,000 applications for translators. And if they all had been approved, that would have effectively doubled the number of licensed radio signals overnight. So far, the FCC has approved 2,000 of these, but the rest are kind of pending in a bureaucratic limbo mode at this time. Obviously, because of all these applications and the awarding of 2,000 FM translator licenses, those are frequencies that are now not going to be available in communities around the country for bona fide local low-power FM community radio. And so the bill that they've introduced this year, which is called the Local Community Radio Act of 2005, repeals what Congress did back in 2000, expands low-power FM back up to its original parameters, and also says that when it comes to translators stations versus low-power FM stations, low-power FM stations will be given priority access to the airwaves. So if ever there's a competing application between some religious broadcaster out of Twin Falls, Idaho, that wants to put a satellite-fed godcaster, as I like to call them, somewhere where, far away in Podunk, Georgia, and there's a Podunk community group that wants to go on the air as a low-power FM station, the community group will get the priority and will get the frequency. Again, whether or not the political conditions are okay on Capitol Hill to allow this bill to flourish, and even whether or not they're going to be able to pick up sponsors, co-sponsors, beyond the three who are really involved in this issue, remains to be seen, but it wouldn't hurt firing off an email or making a phone call to representatives and senators and saying, hey, this might not be a bad idea to support, look into it. It's way overdue.
And the landscape is a little different than it was a year ago. I mean, the FCC just recently on February 8th sponsored a low-power FM day. Can you talk about a little bit what happened there?
Well, that was in many ways a publicity exercise to keep the idea of low-power FM on the policy radar. But at the same time, the FCC needed to show that they weren't being completely deaf to concerns about media diversity and localism, especially after what's happened, with the media ownership controversies that have exploded in the last year and a half. So what they did is they brought in low-power FM activists, people that are running licensed low-power FM stations. They put them in front of the FCC, the commission and commission staff, and they webcast this not only to the world, but they had it on closed-circuit TV within FCC headquarters, so anybody in the building could watch. And they basically talked up what the service did and how it was helping local communities. And it also brought up suggestions on ways that the FCC could possibly expand the service within the restraints that they've been given by Congress. And out of this, apparently, is going to come another low-power FM rulemaking of a sort.
What kind of rulemaking?
This is probably going to be something that goes along the lines of what's happening with the bill in Congress, which is modifying interference protection rules to open up a couple more frequencies around the country for low-power FM and trying to put translators and low-power FM stations in the right priority, meaning low-power FM over translators. If they can do this without having to go to Congress, that's actually kind of a political good maneuver, because the National Association of Broadcasters has a lot of bigger dogs in the fight right now. They just lost a decision at the FCC that said that cable companies will not have to carry their digital multicast TV programming. That's a big loss for them. They're fighting off things on the indecency front, and they may just be stretched to a point where this time around they just have to forfeit the game and not oppose it like they did so strenuously, 5 years ago.
I see. And you mentioned that the National Association of Broadcasters has actually been put on the defensive by these bills. I mean, can you go into a little bit about that, why they've been put into this different position than they were sort of a year ago?
Well, one of the things I think that's kind of critical to this is that the public sentiment has changed over media since 2000. Obviously, there's a lot more awareness of our media environment, what it means, who controls it, who runs it, and that's fostered a lot more discontent than we've seen in the past. So politically, they can't just go to lawmakers and say, hey, we're the ones who know this empirically and technically, and it's only a technical issue, and you need to listen to us because we know what we're talking about, over the unwashed public. Now they're hearing from the public. They know the public is dissatisfied with the state of radio, especially commercial radio, and they're more willing to listen to constituents. And like I mentioned earlier, there are other rulemakings and proceedings happening at the congressional level and at the FCC level, which have larger implications for the NAB. Digital multicasting, getting their signals onto cable systems. They lost at the FCC the ability to do that. They're going to ask for a legislative intervention, so they got to lobby Congress on that front. Indecency. Congress is working on an indecency bill. Broadcasters are not happy about that. They think it's going to, cause a chilling effect. They're working on that. If you politically, rank all of these things relative to each other, is low-power FM worth fighting as it was back in 2000 when the waters were a lot more smoother and policy in general was going the NAB's way and this was just an aberration that needed to be corrected?
I see.
So,
it's just a question of there's so many more battles that they have to fight now that low-power FM has kind of fallen off the map.
Right.
Or at least gotten a lot less attention from their lobbyists.
And that opens up an opportunity for the grassroots to put some pressure on and maybe make something happen. We'll see.
Well, John, another development that you have posted up on DIYmedia.net, and you can read some more information about the link antenna builder. There is a new technology of low power AM that broadcasters and little broadcasters are thinking about implementing. And indeed, we've already got one person, Gary Zico, a professor at the University of Illinois, who's had a lot of press, actually, in the local media, published about him. But it's a Spanish-language station, and it broadcasts from the university, as far as I know, just during the day. Or is it on all night?
I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I'll check tonight, though, and see.
Mm-hmm. The frequency eludes me at this point, but check your dial or look around for it. It's
probably
there.
The expanded band, I think, 16 something.
Yeah, AM? That's right. It's off the AM dial, right?
It's up in the expanded band of the AM. So
not officially up there, but it's part 15 that he's broadcasting under, which means that this is what is part 15?
Part 15 basically means that you can broadcast without a license so long as you're not using a whopping amount of power. And the rules are different between FM and AM. With AM, you can use a little bit more power, and just the nature of AM means your signal might get out a little further than if you were doing FM of the part 15 variety.
You mentioned on your website that his name escapes me. John...
And his name escapes me, too, which is really sad because he's a great guy. Kyle Drake.
Kyle Drake.
Yes. Right. Well, back, you know, what spurred low power FM to be taken up at the political level happened to be the proliferation of unlicensed low power FM stations in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And that was primarily spurred by ease of access to, you know, easily buildable kits that put the technology into people's hands, and they didn't have to become, you know, bona fide broadcast engineers to run a decent radio station on the FM dial. AM, low-power AM, has the same potential, but the antenna that you use in AM broadcasting is a lot more intricate and is also a lot bigger.
Yeah, it has to be really big, because AM radio waves are just really big.
Right, and it's very unwieldy for someone to set, you know, up kind of a hit-and-run low-power AM micro-broadcast station. Well, Kyle Drake is a big fan of AM, and he's effectively developed a homemade tunable loading coil, which effectively allows you to use a shorter antenna, and you tune this thing to the frequency that you want to use, and it helps tune whatever resonator you're using as an antenna to efficiently put out the signal. What that does is it means you don't need as intricate of an antenna system, and the antenna can be a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm.
This is critical, because once we get past this hurdle, then people can start building cost-effective, easy-to-assemble, and easy-to-use low-power AM transmitter kits, and you put those two together, we are staring at the possibility of the same kind of proliferation on the AM dial as we saw on the FM dial that spurred the micro-radio movement and got the FCC to look at low-power FM.
Mm-hmm.
If we have to go through the same thing on the AM dial, we're going to see the proliferation of low-power AM stations, and potentially maybe the FCC will entertain the idea of putting together a low-power AM service. I can say, though, that some of the people that went to LPFM Day brought it up publicly with the FCC that they should consider this. So that's a big, exciting development, especially for those of you who may look at broadcasting low-power community style as an act of electronic civil disobedience, like I do. The idea that LPAM may just be blossoming is great.
This can be done legally, though, under Part 15, using this antenna, as long as you use a power level that's low enough and the antenna meets the specs of the FCC's Part 15 requirements. This antenna, it's very small. I'm looking at it right now. It's a PVC tube that's got some copper wire wrapped around it, and it's got some other things sort of sticking off of it to give it some extra poles. It looks really like a silly science project, but
but it works.
But it works, and it really extends the range of your signal dramatically over, you know, just a little stick that you'd have basically on your front yard.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, this could really be something that people could use legally and get effectively quite a wide broadcast range. I mean, the station here at the University of Illinois that's broadcasting under Part 15 using just a stick antenna, as far as I know, from what I've heard, he's able to cover most of Urbana and pretty much all the area around campus town,
right,
with this legal station.
Yeah.
So this is really quite a powerful technology that could be very much exploited by people that are looking to get into radio legally.
Yes.
And do it.
Yeah, and if you want to know more, Kyle has actually put together the first comprehensive guide to constructing and operating a low-power AM station. He is making it available via the mail. You can go to his website, which is lpam.info. That's all you need to know, lpam.info, and he's put a lot of the information online. It's still growing. Give him some time, but this is a really, really, really cool development and is definitely worth watching.
Well, I agree, John, and I think that's a good place to stop. Thanks so much for being with us on Media Geek. This is John Anderson, founder of DIYmedia.net, and I also neglected to mention that he's the producer of Media Minutes, that is a project of the Free Press, and that's at www.freepress.net/Media Minutes. And I really will have you back again, I'm sure, to talk more about micro broadcasting and low power FM.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.